Hello, I'm Doug, and welcome to the Kuro Japan Podcast, a weekly podcast where we take you on audio journeys through Japanese culture. Welcome back to our podcast. In this episode, we'll be leaping into literature as a means of leveling up your Japanese language skills. Reading is a big part of language learning as a whole, and that's no different when learning a second language. Today, we are joined by Daniel Morales, host and creator of the How to Japanese podcast, to discuss his experiences, sneaky good tips, and approaches to literature-driven language study. By the end of this episode, we hope that you too will have some inspiration to grab a Japanese book and start smashing through some grammar and vocabulary right towards your language growth goals. Let's jump in. All right, welcome back to the Kuro Japan Podcast. So today we are going to talk about language learning, but not just like your typical language learning episode that we've done in the past, but we're going to talk about a different approach to language learning, and that's learning a language, specifically Japanese, through literature or just reading. So we have with us today, Jen and Nigel. Hi, guys.
What's up?
How's it going?
It's a Saturday when we're recording this, so it's pretty great.
Saturday morning, to be exact. Okay. I've been yawning all morning.
You need to get some coffee. And we have a very special guest with us today, Daniel Morales from How to Japanese Podcast and blog and Japan Times fame. So I will let him introduce himself and kind of talk about, you know, just who he is, what he does, and then we'll jump into our typical kind of interview conversation portion of our podcast. So take it away, Daniel.
Sure. So yeah, I'm a writer and translator based in Chicago right now. I am currently enrolled in the IUC Japanese program, which is the Inter-University Center for Japanese Language Studies, which is based in Yokohama. But as you all know, there's no way to get into Japan right now, unfortunately. So we started remotely, which isn't too bad, actually. So I've got classes in the evening, 6 to 10, but I've been in Chicago for 8 years, worked at the Japanese consulate here, and then worked at a trade association for property managers that had a lot of members in Japan. And then before that, I was in grad school at the University of New Orleans doing a creative writing degree. So after this program, I'll be transitioning to full-time freelance writing and translation work.
That's awesome.
Wow, yeah.
Yeah.
And we have another privateer here in the bunch today. So look at that.
Excellent.
I feel like I'm the lone wolf. Get it? Because I went to Loyola Wolf Pack.
Oh, I thought that was a lone wolf and cub reference. Okay.
No, it was totally okay. A really bad Loyola pun.
All these privateers in one podcast. Look at that.
I know.
Yep.
One of the questions we always ask our guests is, what is their connection to New Orleans? Which obviously you have one since you're from here.
Sure.
One of
yeah.
us.
Well, yeah. Born and raised and lived there. Yeah. I was born in Metairie, actually. So I think my brothers were born at Touro, and they always have that over me, I guess. But being born in Metairie, I've got my own little pride for that. So that's cool, I think.
Well, so like, I think a lot nowadays, if you go to Ochsner to have your baby born, you have to go to Ochsner Baptist. So every child, technically, if you go to Ochsner, has to be born in New Orleans, technically, even if you live in like the suburbs. So
wow.
Noah is, you know, he's going to be. He was born, not going to be, he was born in there, and my next kid is going to be born there in a few weeks. So, woo.
Yeah. Well, I was thinking about like New Orleans memories before this podcast, and in terms like specifically with Japan. And I remember like when I was in high school, this was before Barnes and Noble had like the giant manga shelves. And I remember like going out to New Orleans East to this store that had manga, and I was trying to remember where it was, and I can't remember. I'm sure it's gone now.
Is it Crescent City Comics?
I don't think so. I don't remember what it was. Maybe it was, but I just vaguely remember like what the normal comic stores in that I went to, like Uptown and like in Metairie, didn't have it, so I had to go out to New Orleans East to get it. But or maybe Gentilly or somewhere.
It was near UNO, right? Above a laundromat.
Maybe. Yeah that might have been it.
They had a bunch of VHS tapes you can get with like stuff that wasn't released here yet. That was very legal. I'm sure.
Nice.
But yeah, that was.
And you didn't shop there, right, Doug?
Oh, no. I would never. I actually did. That's where I got my Dragon Ball Z VHS tapes when I went to watch Brawley and all the episodes that hadn't been released yet. So
yeah,
but yeah, sorry.
And then the other memory I have is like the Canal Place Theater. I saw Princess Mononoke there, and I think I also saw Howl's Moving Castle there. But one of those two showings, I can't remember which one. I think it was Howl's Moving Castle. I was like waiting for the subbed version. They were showing both the dubbed and the subbed. And I was like, it was like the last week it was showing, the last day of the last week it was showing. And I was waiting for the subbed version, which was the last one that day. And I got there and they were like, actually, the subbed version was damaged by the machine. And we only have the dubbed version left. I was like, ah. So, but that was back before, I think, digital screening. So I can't remember. Maybe that was Mononoke. But either one, like those were early on. Some Japan New Orleans memories for me.
Awesome. Awesome.
So you mentioned, you know, I guess being in New Orleans and getting into manga and anime. For most of our guests, we ask, what is your connection to New Orleans? Have you been? But for you, I guess we're going to have to swap that around. And for you, what is your connection to Japan? How did you get interested in Japan, and what is your Japan journey?
Sure, that's a great question. So I think, like a lot of people in our generation, the last couple of generations, Japan was always there. So, you know, I remember watching like Akira on Sci-Fi Channel on Saturday morning. That kind of was just present. And I wasn't totally crazy about manga and anime, but was into it for sure. And then I remember in high school, one of my English teachers had us writing haiku, and he would have us send them out to magazines, and I had one published, and that was like kind of interesting. And there was a teacher also in our high school who had been on JET, and he showed us parts of the movie Tampopo. He was selectively editing the parts that he showed us. He'd be like, okay, I have to stop here and fast forward like, you know, 2 minutes. We can't watch this section. But I remember seeing that movie. And so there were all these like little things that were kind of like adding up to, okay, Japan, you know, building my awareness of Japan. And I did a project on Basho for my senior year. Now that I remember it, but I think even that was inspired by, like, between junior and senior year of high school, I read Haruki Murakami's novel, Hardboiled Wonderland and the End of the World. I bought it at Boku Books on Magazine Street, which is no longer there. Ain't there no more, you know, a good example of ain't there no more. And then like I read that book that summer and was just like blown away by it. And so spent like my senior year reading like as much as I could get my hands on, and then did that project on Basho my senior year. And that was kind of when I was like, okay, I want to like learn the language. And then when I got to college, studied Japanese, and then through that program was able to kind of go over a couple summers, and then ended up there on JET. And so that was really that was my path there.
Wow. So just to clarify, did you study abroad while you were in college?
Mm-hmm.
Was it through UNO?
No, it was. So I went to Harvard for undergrad.
Okay.
And they had a great Japanese program. They had a lot of ways to kind of get involved over there. One was they had this internship program in Okayama, which was through the Rotary Club there. And so I went as a Rotary intern and was at a propeller company, which is very random. But they had this division that was designing ceramic plates and things for houses, ceramic lights. And so I did that. And then, unrelated to the Japanese program, the guidebook Let's Go was created through Harvard students, and they did a Japan book. And so I went one summer for that. And then I took a year off to study abroad, and that was also made possible through the Japanese program, through a grant from them. And yeah, I did a year in Tokyo and, you know, majored in Japanese and went over on JET when I graduated. That was like the only thing I applied for. So I'm really glad I got in.
Yeah.
Because I was like, you know, 22 and had no idea how to get a job or anything. So
so you didn't have a plan B. Like, that was it. JET or nothing.
I don't know. Yeah. Yeah.
That was me too.
Well, you know, sometimes I feel like when that happens, it's like, it's because you're destined to do it. You know, it's the one thing you apply for and you get it, and you know, it's the stars aligning for you. So you must have taken the right path.
It was good. Yeah, it was the right place to be. It was a good, I was 3 years in Fukushima with Doug. And I remember I was at like the Fukushima orientation, and I was like, I'm from New Orleans, and Doug, like, heard Doug go, what, or something like that. You know, so
yeah, that sounds like Doug.
Yeah.
That's, it's crazy that that's where we met. We didn't meet here in New Orleans. We met in Fukushima City in Japan. So it was like small world. And then it's, that's kind of like a theme with, I feel like, Jet and just foreigners traveling to Japan. It's a very small world vibe. Everyone, I don't want to say everyone knows everyone, but you probably, there's like a definitely a 7 degrees of separation to somebody that you probably know.
So even though you went to Harvard for your undergrad, you still left as a Jet here in New Orleans when the consulate was here.
Yes, that's a good, that's a good point. I applied through the Boston consulate. I remember this. I was there in Boston that summer. And so I actually did summer orientation through the Boston consulate. But it was a bit of a process to apply through the Boston consulate and then leave through New Orleans, because I didn't want to. I knew I wanted to come home to New Orleans, get all my stuff out of Boston, live at home for, you know, a month or a couple weeks at least and see family. And then, at the time, this was pre-Katrina. So I left. I left for Jet in 2005, you know, a month before Katrina hit. And the consulate was still there at the time. I remember really vividly going out to the consul general's residence for the departure party. And I remember reading somewhere, I don't know if I remember, it was like on the consulate website or in some kind of literature, but the consul general at the time was like obsessed with New Orleans. And he had come to New Orleans in the 60s because he just loved jazz or something. And he had like no money and just came here and like slept on a bench because he like didn't have enough money to stay at a hotel, but was like having a great time back in the 60s, which just strikes me as such an awesome like Japan New Orleans connection. Like,
and
absolutely
not surprising at all. That was, left through the New Orleans consulate, which, I don't know how long it was in New Orleans afterwards, but it's in Nashville now, unfortunately. Doug, did you go through the New Orleans consulate when you left?
Yeah, I did. We had our pre-departure orientation and a similar thing with like going to the consul general's home for a party out of New Orleans. But I want to say that we were maybe the last or second to last. I'm not really sure, but I know it was pretty soon after that they had decided to move from New Orleans, or maybe they had already decided at that point, but it was still like in progress. They hadn't really officially moved. So that was I kind of missed being downtown and being able to access having that instant access if you need to, especially now with for like my wife and my son, they have Japanese passports, and if they need to renew their passport, they have to go to Nashville. There's no easy way to do this. Like, there's no mailing process. You have to go in person to hand over the passport. So it's kind of a pain in the butt, but they come here once or twice a year or something like that. But COVID's been kind of preventing that kind of stuff.
Yeah, I keep thinking about the Jets going this year and needing to get tested before they go over, and just can't even imagine, like, if you're in, you know, Kansas and have to go through the Chicago consulate, like, you have to probably get tested in Kansas, then fly to Chicago and like pray to God that you're still that you're going to test negative, and then, you know, stay in Chicago overnight and then go. It's just, or you have to come to Chicago and then arrange a test. You know, it's the logistics, just the logistical hurdles are just exponentially more difficult this year.
Yeah. And especially I don't know if it's new Jets that got selected this year or if it's ones that maybe were selected for 2020 that are getting, it's just got to be such a draining, emotionally draining
for sure. Yeah.
Experience.
Just, they're finally starting to go. I think the Chicago Jets go on October 2nd. So, it's coming up. Yeah.
Soon. Wow. Yeah. That's like next week.
Yep.
Well, now that we kind of have an idea of who Daniel is, you know, I want to get into the meat of the episode. So Daniel, for you, you know, what is your relationship with the Japanese language? What made you kind of want to start even learning Japanese?
Yeah, so for me, it was really Haruki Murakami, the novelist. You know, he's, for anyone who doesn't know, he was born, I think, in the late 40s. He's still writing. He got started in the late 70s and early 80s writing short novels and short stories, and then has developed into a writer who writes these massive, you know, long novels every 7 years or so, 5 to 7 years. And so read one of his books, Hardboiled Wonderland and the End of the World, which is one he wrote in 1985, and was just blown away by it. Hadn't read anything like it. It's a novel told in two stories, alternating chapters, and it's got a sci-fi element, it's got a fantasy element. And I wanted to read it in Japanese. And so that really pushed me into the language program. And then I knew if I wanted to just keep going with it, I had to get over to Japan somehow. And once I got to Japan, I just kind of fell in love with the country and the culture. And that's changed over time, obviously, what I'm interested in. And Murakami is someone I'm still interested in. I'm still following his work. But I'm interested in other writers now, other aspects of Japanese culture. That's really just kind of kept me going. And then the language itself, to be honest, is really motivating. It's just so interesting and fascinating and challenging that it really keeps me going.
That's interesting that, you chose literature, like Japanese literature, as your like point of interest to learn the language. Yeah. 'Cause like a lot of times, especially like, because I work for a study abroad program, so like I hear all the reasons, and the number one reason that I hear is obviously the anime and manga aspect, that pop culture. Mm. But I know Nigel has like a high interest in like film, so that's like really interesting to know. And I just like to know like the differences of like where everyone has their outlets from and what's their motivation. So that's really nice that yours is literature, because I'm an English major as well. So I love that aspect.
Yeah. And one thing I was going to say is like, you know, people really absorb content in a variety of ways when it comes to studying language in general, not just Japanese, but any language. Some prefer to lean on those textbooks as guide, whilst others may choose like you, books and manga or music or podcast, you know, the variety of different types of media. What are some of your preferred ways of improving or expanding your own grasp on Japanese?
Yeah, it's really changed over time in terms of like what I have access to. Obviously, for the first couple of years, it was the courses that I was in. Then once you get out, you kind of have to set your own curriculum, as it were. You know, what are you going to be doing with the language to kind of keep yourself connected to it? And that's changed for me over time. As I mentioned, you know, Murakami's work is something I follow. And when a big novel comes out, I usually try and read it and, you know, set a pace, you know, like if it's 10 to 20, 30 pages a day, whatever I can afford at the time based on my day job. That's really good to stay engaged. Netflix has been huge in the last like 5 to 10 years with creating access to shows and anime. And one thing I love to do there is watch a Japanese show with the Japanese audio, but also with the Japanese closed captions. So you're hearing it and you're reading the Japanese at the same time, which I think reinforces what you're hearing. And you're not like constantly rewinding to try and make sure you caught things. You can pause it and like look up a word. And if it's on the screen, it's a little bit easier to find a kanji, for example. That's super helpful. And then recently, starting like last fall, I kind of like doubled down. I was like, you know, you're not doing enough. You need to do a little bit more. You're living abroad. You're not engaging with the language enough. And so I started listening to the NHK radio podcast. So NHK is the Nippon Hoso Kyokai, the Japanese national broadcaster. And it's basically, I would say, the equivalent of like the BBC for Japan. They've got, you know, television news, radio news, and they put out the radio news in podcast form. And these come out like, you know, every hour. They have little 5-minute news blasts. 7 a.m. and p.m. they have like a 15 to 20 minute news summary, which I find is really good. I generally listen to the 7 a.m. and the 7 p.m. every day. And then during the week, they have what they call a journal Janaru episodes every evening at 10 p.m. So, you know, it comes out in the U.S. in the mornings. And I listen to those. Those are a little bit meatier in terms of the content and has more news analysis. They have different themes depending on the day of the week. They'll take listener questions. And so things like that, that really keeps me engaged. And, you know, it's funny, having really committed to that for just about a year now, like I find that my listening skills have really improved and I'm understanding way more than I did at the beginning when it's just kind of coming at you full blast and you're just trying to pick out little things here and there that you can understand. But I do think that, you know, little things here and there combined with like looking up things really kind of expands what you can do pretty quickly without you even realizing it.
Yeah, those I had seen you on Twitter recommending those podcasts a few times. And I haven't actually given it a listen yet, but I feel like that's really for people who may be intimidated by picking up a newspaper and, you know, trying to read and having that barrier of kanji and not knowing how to read those kanji because they don't always have, they don't have furigana on newspapers. So, you know, not having that barrier, it would, you know, you can hear the words and you can kind of maybe that, maybe people are more receptive to that. So yeah, I want to give that a try. Yeah. I'm pretty sure I'd struggle and just barely pick up like maybe like 20% of like what's going on. Cause I'd be like, I'm really rusty, but
no, that's good. That's good though. I mean, you know, I think the other thing is that the 5-minute news blasts are interesting because a lot of it's repeated, you know, if these 5-minute hourly news blasts, it's like basically going to be the same thing. It's like a little quick snippet on the COVID situation, a little quick snippet on politics or whatever, and you'll start to get things. The other thing that helped me realize that I don't think I had fully realized at first, I mean, the written language is part of it, but the real Japanese language is what is being spoken between people. And you need to start associating like sounds with meaning in a way that maybe you're not fully doing at first. And so like, you know, you'll start to realize, okay, you know, like, the sound gaku, that sounds a sound I associate with school. You know, the sound to is a sound I associate with political parties. You know, economics, keizai, you know, things like that. And you'll start to do that in a way that maybe you wouldn't if you're not like constantly listening in a way and being forced to not look at the language. So yeah, well, like while I said earlier that Netflix, it's good to look at it. At the same time, you need to be practicing like listening to, I think, which is, it's really interesting. I think it's definitely worth giving it a shot. Even the 5-minute ones might be a little bit more tolerable just because it's so brief and you can get just a little snippet and then, you know, get a very similar snippet again. And really the only downside with these podcasts is that they don't, you're not allowed to see the entire archive. They get deleted pretty quickly. So you need to either download an episode and before it gets removed from your podcast listener or listen to it immediately and online through the website. Okay. That's the one downside. Yeah.
Wow. And do they come with transcripts?
That's a good question. You know, I haven't looked. They don't, at least with the, I listened on Overcast and so they don't have it there, but you know, I wouldn't be surprised if they were available somewhere, just given that Japan is generally pretty good with accessibility. Yeah, maybe I can look into that and see if I can send you guys a link. Yeah.
Oh, cool. That'd be great. Yeah. Cause I think that's, like you said, like having obviously listening is really important, but being able to associate those sounds with the, you know, the visual kanji that go with it, I think it kind of plays off each other.
Yeah.
You know, there's a lot of ping pong that goes on in learning that stuff.
Yeah,
totally.
So if you could rewind the clock back and let's say you are a beginner at learning Japanese and you wanted to learn through this kind of immersive experience, like you've been saying.
Yeah.
And specifically like today, that main episode is talking about literature. Where would you begin with Japanese literature and immersing yourself?
That's a good question. Yeah. So I mean, the key thing is you have to be reading something that you enjoy and something that you want to read. And so always keeping that in mind is that, like, what are you interested in outside of Japan? Like what's driving you? What are you like looking into normally on your free time? you know, is that basketball, for me, it was beer brewing. And so I bought a book on brewing beer and the beer history, and I was able to read that and use it as a senior project in my Japanese class. But the other thing that I didn't do, kind of, was this system called Tadoku, which is, it means reading a lot, basically. So ta is the character for oi, so a lot, you often. And then doku is yomu, so reading. And it is an organization, tadoku.org, is something I got turned on to through a guy I interviewed for my podcast, who I had been friends with on Twitter for a while, Daniel McKella. And he's a translator now, but he is, so impressive, like almost entirely like self-taught, like, and Tadoku is, they have these things called graded readers, and they're readers reading or books that are have specific levels to them. So they have, like, you know, level one is very easy, level two, and they start at like almost like children's literature, but they get up to more like novels, and then they have recommendations for different things that are outside, that aren't published by them, I think. And then they have four rules. They say start from scratch, don't use a dictionary, skip over difficult words, phrases, and passages, and if it's too hard or if you don't like it, get rid of it, which I think are all good rules and stuff that I was like kind of starting to apply on my own in my own reading practice. I got there kind of the long way around rather than starting there, you know, because I've been reading in class, stories and things like that, but it will feel more real if you're kind of invested in a specific book, if you're like, okay, this is a thing that I'm going to get through on my own. But the Tadoku system also is designed to kind of teach you to read like a native speaker, because even when you're reading in English, you're not, I think if next time you read in English, try this, like try paying attention. Okay, how much of this am I really fully understanding? And you'll start to realize, oh wait, okay, maybe there's a word here or there that I'm skipping over just because I understand it through context, but maybe I'm only understanding like 70 to 80%. And can you get there in Japanese? You know, can I get to the point where I'm like basically getting through it? So like reading with the goal of not understanding every word, but also enjoying it, reading for the goal of enjoying it, and also reading for volume. I think that's a goal you can have. But so Tadoku is a great place to start. In terms of other material specifically, I would say there's a writer called Ogawa Mime. He's like a children's literature writer, old school. There's a lot available on, it's in the public domain on this website called Aozora Bunko. And it's public domain literature uploaded by volunteers. So volunteers are literally looking at these books, typing it up themselves, and then uploading the documents. And for whatever reason, you know, one volunteer has decided, I'm going to upload like everything by Ogawa Mime. And so the website shows you what's new, what's been newly uploaded. And for whatever reason, there's always new stuff from him. So he's a good one. There's a writer, Hoshi Shinichi, who's really famous for short stories. And he's like a kind of a sci-fi writer. He's someone I would recommend for beginners. I remember my teachers had us read a book by him that was, or not a book, a little short story that was about the narrator's like talking to the reader, and he's like telling the reader, oh, in Japan, you know, if there's only one okashi left, no one will eat it because it's the, you know, the last one. And that's what the etiquette says, is no one eats the last one because it would be rude to take the last one. And then it comes out at the very end that he's a vampire and the reader is the only human left in the world, but we're not going to eat you because you're the only human left in the world. So it was like, he's got stories like that, that are kind of, there's a twist to them. They're funny, but they involve Japanese culture sometimes. And then I would also recommend manga. You know, I wish I had read more manga starting out, just because, you know, you've got pictures with it. There's a huge variety. It doesn't have to be, like, if you have this conception that manga is one thing, like, you're mistaken, because they have manga for everyone. And you just need to find out, like, kind of like what I said at the beginning, what are you interested in? What's going to propel you forward through a text? And like, if you can center that at your, in your thinking, that couldn't drive a lot of your choices.
Yeah, I use manga personally a lot. Just because I do find it is easy for, like, visually, like the eyes, because, like, it's already broken up for you in little bubbles. Just focus on one bubble, then go to the next. Like, so that's my go-to is manga. So I relate to that one.
Yeah.
Yeah. And actually, when I was on Jet, I picked up Eye Shield 21, which is like an American football manga that came out during the late 2000s or whatever year it was. But I know I picked that up, and I was, again, like, kind of following that thing. Like, I wanted to find something that was interesting to me, and I really like football. So I wanted to, like, read this, and I think it was translated into English, but I wanted to give it a stab in Japanese because I kind of was interested in learning what the words were, you know, how they translated some of the penalties and, you know, like, different just football terminology. So that was one of those things where I just kind of kept powering through it. And it's, I definitely, when you find something you're interested in, it makes it much more, I guess it makes you more determined to keep going, as opposed to if you're just picking up a book and you don't really know what it's about, but you're like, I'm gonna give it a try. You're not invested. So I totally feel that aspect of finding the right type of literature. And one thing I would do too, I taught elementary school on Jet. So, and I know Daniel, you did too, right? Yep. Or did you do all grade levels?
I did pre-K through junior high. So I didn't do, okay. I did not do high school, but everything else. Yeah.
I would pick up kids' books from, like, the school's library and just kind of, like, sift through them just to read. Or I'd see, like, a second grader or a third grader reading something. I'm like, you know what? I probably can understand about the same like reading level as them. So that was, I always kind of tell people if they ask, like, you know, don't be afraid of, like, getting into kids' books, because it's geared towards people who are still forming their language ability.
Totally.
So that's just my, you know, kind of my experience with those types of things too.
Definitely.
Yeah. And, you know, it seems like one kind of common thread that was running through all of the things you suggested was something that we've discussed in previous episodes and perhaps could be credited back. I don't know if he was the first guy to come up with it, but Stephen Krashen is a linguist, and he talks a lot about when you're learning a language, you need comprehensible input in the very early stages. You need a lot of input, but specifically input that you can understand and is on your level. And you keep gradually increasing the level of difficulty of that comprehensible input. But I assume that's something you agree with as well.
Definitely. Yeah. I mean, input is key. Like, you need to do massive input for sure. And, like, that, yeah, reading for volume is something that you need to get to eventually, for sure. Yeah. Like, and that, so yeah, reading for comprehension and volume, I think is key. Yeah. And yeah, the children's books.
Yeah, because my mother-in-law gave me a marine biology children's book. And let me just say, I don't understand anything in that book.
Yeah, no, and that actually kind of brings us to our next question is, you know, like, me personally, I've gone into, like, Book Off in Tokyo back when I lived there, and would pick up, like, a couple, like, small Japanese novels and, you know, with the aspiration of, like, you know what? I'm going to do it. I'm going to finally get through a book. And then I get through, like, page one, and I'm just frustrated because either I overestimated my level or, you know, whatever. It was just, you know, you get that frustration. You hit a wall really early, and it's just like, why even bother? You know, like, so at what point did you feel confident enough in your ability to decide to kind of challenge yourself to pick up, like, a more complicated or more complex Japanese book and try to read through it? And, like, what was that book?
Sure.
That you read to completion?
That's a good question. So I kind of did it the long way around. You know, I had classes, but I don't think it was until third or fourth year when I really felt comfortable reading a lot. But I had a lot of help. You know, there was a graduate student in one of my seminars that wasn't a language class. He really helped me kind of walk through a couple of short stories. I had Japanese teachers walking us through kind of some of the stories that I mentioned. And then when I studied abroad, I did an independent study with a professor, and we read these two novels that had just won the Akutagawa Prize by Kanehara Hitomi and Wataya Arisa. And that was that would have been 2003 or 2004 when they won. They were the youngest. One of them was the youngest prize winner. That's one of the famous literary prizes in Japan. And so that was really good. I was reading like, you know, 2 pages a day, and I would be able to go in once a week and ask her questions about what the content meant, how this grammar was working, things like that. And then after that was kind of, those two books were formative and also a breakthrough. And then after that, I was kind of on my own, and I was felt comfortable trying to read just whole books without kind of doing a more Tadoku method where you're not looking it up. Maybe you mark, circle something and come back to it later. But you're just trying to kind of read for the feel, to get a general understanding, read, understand things through context. And so I read a Murakami short story collection that I ended up reading, studying for my senior thesis. And then I read Kafka on the Shore, which was the latest Murakami at that point, which hadn't been translated. And I got through about half of that before my senior year of college and wasn't able to finish it. But then I remember I finished it like my first couple months on JET. And then read the English. And that was kind of a cool feeling. But yeah, it took a little while. But again, like I do think like if I had used a different strategy and started with the Tadoku method with maybe slightly easier material and going for volume earlier on, maybe that's a different path than I took. But I'm also really like passionate about helping people get to that point where they feel more comfortable to read. So through the US JET Alumni Association, I help run a reading group, a monthly Japanese reading group. And every month we do a short reading in Japanese and everybody kind of reads it on their own. And then we get together and we literally go through sentence by sentence. Everyone takes a turn. They read a sentence in Japanese and then they kind of say what they think it means or give a provisional translation. And then we kind of go over any questions and things like that. So that's available for anyone. You don't have to be a JET alum to join. I can send you guys the information for that. We have a Facebook group.
Sounds
great.
Yeah, that sounds amazing.
And it's good. It's, yeah. So I do know that it is a challenge at first. And so love to help support people, you know, in the early stages.
Well, speaking of challenges, I think all three of us can agree that there are many challenges to learning Japanese. You know, my devil is, you know, kanji. Kanji is difficult. Some people may find the grammar difficult, and then some may just find it really hard to just like soak in all of the vocabulary that you have to learn. But you know, what are like any kind of, are there any other like hurdles that maybe like Japanese learners should know and consider when reading like books in Japanese?
Yeah, there are a couple that I can think of. One is maybe obvious, maybe not, is that they read vertically. So you're reading up to down rather than left to right. And so I do think that you need to train your eyes to do that. Your eyes are going to be sore at first and until you get used to that reading method. You know, obviously reading online, you're going to have horizontal news articles and things like that. So that's one way if you're struggling with that at first. But I do think it's good to kind of get used to reading vertically. And that's true in manga. You know, that's a good way to get into it. They do vertically in manga, and you can kind of get started there before you jump into something longer. The other thing I think that's important to do is to kind of be aware of what kind of reading you're doing. It's like, okay, today I'm going to do close reading. I'm going to like look up every word, look up every grammar pattern on a page, look up every kanji. And then maybe tomorrow I'm just gonna read more loosely and just kind of get through it. Because I think one thing that's really interesting is that you start to realize that when you're reading, you're not reading on a kanji or individual character level. This is true of any language. You're processing things in much broader, larger chunks of the language. And so like when you read an English word, you're not reading it on the letter level, for example, right? Like you're not even aware. It makes the word makes a shape that, you know, clicks with a meaning in your head. And you need to get to that point with Japanese too. And the way you can do that is by reading more for volume, reading more loosely, trying to understand things from context. and rather than being frustrated by every word. I mean, you kind of get to the same place if you look up every word, I think, right? Like, you'll eventually look up so many words that you'll get to the point where you don't need to look them up, and then you're reading that way. But if you can kind of train yourself, I remember, like, when I was in third year Japanese, one of my teachers had us do this exercise where she would give us a news article and she would hide it from us somehow, and then she would show us the headline and we could look at the headline for like 10 seconds and then she would ask us a question about it, and then she would let us look she would give us a question about the news article, and then she'd give us like two paragraphs of the article, and we'd have like 10 seconds to like look at those two paragraphs to try and find that information. And what she was doing is she was like, these were basically repetitions at, you know, a Japanese reading gym. And we were kind of doing that quick, broad, fast reading rather than a close reading. We were trying to train our eyes to scan for different compounds in a way that you need to be able to do if you're going to read fluently in any language. So that's one thing I think to be aware of is like, okay, what kind of reading am I doing today? Is that affecting how I'm feeling about this reading? Do I need to switch it up? Things like that, I think, are important to consider. Oh, and then one other thing, take notes. I think that even for me now, like being able to read, I do think some of it seems to just kind of go in through one ear or, you know, and then out the other side without retaining it. And you can kind of, I find that one of my grad student advisors in undergrads recommended, you know, just take notes in the margin in English and say, okay, this is what happened broadly in this paragraph or in this page. And that way you're kind of cementing your understanding of it. And you have those notes to go back to if you need to reference it or something. So that's something I still do. And then with Murakami, actually, like when I'm reading one of his novels, after each chapter, I'll write like a quick summary so that I can, I mean, that's useful for me if I'm writing a review or something later, but I do think it also just kind of helps cement your understanding of what happened and forces you to kind of digest what you're reading.
Do you write your summary in English or Japanese?
English, yeah. Okay. It's just quicker. You know, yeah. Like, obviously, like, it would be better for my writing practice if I could do it in Japanese, but, like, yeah, I think, yeah, in English, just for speed, because it just needs to be quick, you know? It shouldn't take much more than, like, you know, a minute or two, you know? Like, this character did X, Y, and Z. Like, if you can summarize it in, like, two sentences, that's perfect.
Do you ever come across like hurdles, like cultural hurdles, where maybe like there's just something that doesn't make sense because like you're reading, you're like, wait, what am I reading? Like it's something very unique to like, or just, you know, like when reading American books, if a person does something, it's like we get the context of how they're doing or why they're doing that. In those type of cultural context situations, maybe when you're reading, it just doesn't make sense, or idioms or things like that, where it just doesn't click. Like, have you really encountered a lot of those when reading some of the content you've read?
Yeah, you know, I mean, there's inside jokes, there's like references to different, like, you know, pop culture that maybe I'm not familiar with. Yeah. That's hard. I translated one light novel, and during that I had a Japanese teacher actually, and I was asking her questions, and she was helpful in kind of tracking some of those down. She's like, oh, okay, this is like a joke about this commercial. And that was an example from that book. So it's useful to have a language partner. And, you know, that was from an online teacher that I could buy lessons in blocks of 10, I think, for like $300. So it was like $30 a lesson, which isn't bad at all, to be honest. And but that would be something absolutely worth considering if you're investing in your language study, you know, absolutely worth it, I think. And and then the other thing is just Googling, like just lots and lots of Googling, and like making sure that like when you're Googling, you're isolating the language in quotation marks, like little pieces of the language to try and see how it's being used here and there and whether it changes things. If you're isolating different pieces of it, I find that's super helpful.
That's a good call out. Yeah, because I've definitely done the Google where I just take a chunk of a sentence and I say, what the hell does this mean? Just throw it in there. Like, I don't get it.
Yeah. Yeah. Same.
Yeah. Like, if you ever create a sentence in Japanese and there are no examples of it on the internet, that's always a little suspicious to me, because it's like, you shouldn't be inventing new language. Like it, and obviously full sentences is a different story, but like little, you know, for example, a verb, a particle, and the object of that particle or the subject, right? Like combinations like that shouldn't be that unique. You should be able to find some examples of it. So if you ever need to kind of check something, that's a good way to do it. But yeah, that's like a little writing hack. Cool. That I use.
Well, you had mentioned earlier the Kutagawa Prize as mm-hmm. a good way of like finding out literature. And I wanted to see if you could share a little bit more about that, just in case that mm-hmm. way, you know, people are interested in looking into that, or maybe some prize winners.
That's a really good point. The Japanese literary scene is really vibrant. And so the Kutagawa Prize is the main prize for what they call junbungaku, so pure literature, which is more literary fiction. But there's lots of different literary prizes. There's tons of literary magazines. And one thing that I had a lot of fun doing when I was living there was just kind of trying to get a sense of how it worked. So they have these magazines, and I would go to a store and do, you know, tachiyomi, which is standing and reading, and looking at the indexes, looking at the author names, trying to figure out who was involved in what. They have these things called taidan, which are interviews, but they're basically two writers having a conversation, a dialogue, and they just transcribe it for the magazine. So it was Japan invented the podcast years ago, but they just called it the taidan, and they printed it rather than put it in audio form. Those are all fun ways to kind of get involved. And then the Akutagawa Prize is cool because they also, and all these prizes, because they'll publish the winner in the magazine, but they also publish the judges' comments on it, so you can read what these people think of a literary work, and you can get the language of literary criticism. That's something that's fun to learn. You can start to understand how the different magazines are different, how the different writers are different, which writers are in right now, which writers are out. You know, like I was really lucky. The last time I went to Japan, I think it would have been 2019. I was kind of just doing that, and I found that Murakami had like a short nonfiction article about his father in it, which went on to get translated and published in the New Yorker. But I was able to read it in Japanese, and kind of that was a fun thing. So I always like that. And then you can like finding your own new writers that are like new, that maybe aren't being translated yet. That's always, I think, that can be a motivating thing if that's something you're interested in. But yeah, and then the Akutagawa Prize is just so big and kind of interesting. And there's always a little bit of drama with it. So that's something that can be a motivational aspect that propels you through your reading.
Yeah. So I think thus far, I think you've given listeners and us like a treasure trove of resources to explore, to really take our Japanese to the next level. But for people who, let's say they want your number one resource of where do I start? Let's see, what's the best book or blog or haiku or whatever, you know, what would you recommend? And let's say for a beginner, an intermediate, and an advanced, what would you say? Okay, this is a good place for you to start with this book or resource.
So I was thinking about this question, and I decided that I was going to answer all Murakami, because that's really kind of where I got into it. So I've got Murakami for beginners, Murakami for intermediate. Yeah,
he's a Murakami fanboy.
Murakami for advanced. So the short stories is something I mentioned earlier with Hoshi Shinichi, but Murakami has his own collection of short stories, which is really fun. It's called Yoru no Kumozaru, so the spider monkey at night. And it's literally like two-page stories, and they're all a bit funny and weird. Some of them are easier than others. I would say most of them are pretty easy, but there's a handful that are just so weird that they can be a little bit confounding. But for the most part, that's a perfect spot for beginners, because it's a perfect amount. You can really look up every word and kind of understand what it's saying. And a lot of them are so silly. like the title story is about a writer trying to write, and the spider monkey comes in through the window and is annoying him. And there's a lot of wordplay that is almost impossible to translate into English, but it's wordplay about hiragana, wordplay about katakana. And so that's a story that I think as a Japanese learner, you can really enjoy because you're able to access that joke. And it's not an inside joke. It's just a silly little language thing. That's a great place to start. You can find it for, 200 yen at a used bookstore. For intermediate Murakami, one thing that I would recommend is some of his nonfiction. He's written a lot of advice columns, which haven't been translated into English. He did this through like the Asahi newspaper and more recently through his own website. So he's got a lot of different collections. One, I think, is called Murakami Radio, Murakami Radio. There's one, I think it's called the Murakami Asahido or something like that, where... or Murakami-san no Tokoro, I think, is one that he did earlier on through the Asahi. So he was doing like this kind of online thing, taking reader questions like back in the early 90s or maybe the late 80s. I can't remember. Those are all super interesting because they're very like real to life. It's like reader questions like, I can't think of anything off the top of my head, but it's literally mundane stuff like what kind of like toaster oven do you have or something like that, So it's like, very like concrete, real to life content, which is I think sometimes easier to parse than like literary fiction, which I think can be very until you start to kind of get a good sense of the writers, the way they're portraying the world, describing the world, it can be hard to kind of like situate yourself. And then for advanced Murakami readers, I would recommend Norwegian Wood is a really good one. I mean, think that's like probably one of his easiest to read because it's very like real to life. It's not much sci-fi stuff. It starts off pretty quickly. I would also recommend Wild Sheep Chase. That's a good one. That's one of his more earlier works. So it's a bit of a combination of some of the stuff that he was really well known for, like magic realism and combined with the kind of response to the post-war or the protest movements during the Vietnam War and the student movements, the kind of jaded 80s Japanese response to that. So that's kind of interesting. And then Wind Up Bird Chronicle 2 is a huge one, but I think one that would be really interesting to read. I would recommend that over some of his newer ones, because it would probably be easier to read because it's just more everyday than some of his newer stuff and more happens in the book, I think, than 1Q84 or Killing Commendatore. So those would be my Murakami recommendations, I think. But yeah, if you need any other recommendations, feel free to hit me up on Twitter or something like that. But yeah, Murakami is what I know best. So I did want to give a kind of a variety for people.
Yeah, it's great. I kind of want to check out the spider monkey thing.
I'm surprised it hasn't been translated yet, to be honest. I really am. They're so fun. My only guess is that he doesn't really want them translated because he thinks they're too light or something like that. But like, I'm sure they'll come out eventually, even if it's like 100 years when they're in public domain or something like that. But yeah, they're a fun little set of stories. Yeah, he was.
Is it like a compendium?
He did two sets, like basically. So he published them in magazines. And they were accompanied by these illustrations by Anzai Mizumaru, which was an artist that he worked with for a long time, who's a pretty interesting artist. I think he's passed away, but he's got this kind of almost like Keith Haring feel to his art, very pop art, very like weird modern still life, pictures of like records and things that are very like kind of simple. And so the stories that, I can't remember which magazines they were published in, but one of them, they were kind of effectively advertisements. They were advertisements for J Press, which is a men's fashion line, which I think started in the US, but might even be owned by a Japanese company now. And then the second set was, I think, for watches. And so they were kind of these weird, like, semi-advertisement, semi-commercial products, but so weird that like it was really purely just fun literature. And so, you know, you got stories like kind of running gags about this repairman coming over to repair a pipe, and like he sees a kotatsu and he thinks the kotatsu is a time machine, and the narrator's like, yes, my time machine, you know. And so it's these kind of bizarre everyday stories that are, again, super short, super easy, relatively simple writing. Can't recommend it highly enough. Yeah,
cool. Yeah, I'm gonna look into those, because I feel like that's, if it's beginner level, that's probably where I need to start, because it's been a long time since I've tried reading Japanese.
Yeah, that's where I need to start. But the column sounds really cool too. Like, yeah, I want to know what type of toaster Murakami uses. That's fascinating.
Definitely. And then, you know, that was online for a little while. I think they might have taken it off, but maybe you can find it. I'll have to look. I'll try and see if I can find it on archive.org, because sometimes, you know, those sites will get cached. If I find it, I will send you all the link, and maybe you can include it in the show notes.
That would be amazing.
That'd be great. So I did want to pull back a second and maybe ask you a little bit more about your experiences with writing for the Japan Times, because I know that you have written articles and contributed quite a bit for them. Are most of your works published in English only, or do you sometimes publish in Japanese as well?
It's all English only, with a lot of Japanese examples, so sentences and grammar and vocab and things like that. I'm interested in writing in Japanese, but I'm not to that point yet. It's hard, but I'm curious to know, you know, as somebody who's a writer, but also as somebody who taught writing at UNO when I was a grad student, and like kind of realized how I got better as a writer and watched, you know, non-native speakers get better at writing English. I'm now curious to know, is that something I can do? But yeah, at this point, just English.
So another question just about that. What is the peer review process for those like article submissions? Like, is there a peer review process, or they looked at it, or did you just submit it and then the editor kind of sifts through and says, yeah, this is good, we're going to just publish as is, or how does that work?
Yeah, they have a great staff at the Japan Times. You know, they've got a lead editor, but they also have a lot of proofreaders. Generally, you know, it goes through two or three people, and one of those is a native Japanese speaker. So all my phrases get checked, which is a huge help, because they'll catch things here and there. But yeah, I think I've gotten to a good point where we're really comfortable. If there's anything that's kind of not working in a piece, they'll give me a chance to kind of rework it. But for the most part, I do feel I've been writing it for, man, going on 10 years now. And, I feel really comfortable in that form and that like word count. So it's one that I really enjoy writing, for sure.
Cool. Cool. Yeah. Cause I know, obviously reading a newspaper in English, you learn a lot of stuff like vernacular, just on what the current trends are. And we talked about it earlier too, just the importance of just understanding what's going on in the world and how to phrase that in Japanese. I mean, it just gives you more conversation pieces, because I'm sure if it's news, people are talking about it outside of, you know, the newspaper.
Absolutely.
In real life. Like, if you go, I know when I was on JET, like going into the teacher's room, you know, that would help with small talk, you know, just the current topics over there in the news. So, it's definitely something I know that helped kind of, I guess, make me a little bit more approachable or interesting, I guess, because I could carry some kind of conversation based off of what was going on. But so that's cool.
Newspapers can be a little bit intimidating in Japanese, because it's just like this wall of text, you know, like especially if you get a paper version. But like, even if you're like just looking at the headline, that's good practice. You know, even if you're just reading the lead paragraph, right, like make it something manageable for yourself. Don't force yourself to do the whole thing. Bite off a little chunk, you know, and say, okay, this is what I'm doing today. And say, I'm going to do that, you know, once a day. Like, really, consistency is king, I think, you know, with Japanese study. And I find for me, that's always been the most valuable, rather than saying I have to do a huge amount, saying I have to do a little bit every day. You know, how can I make it easy for myself? It needs to be somewhat substantial, right? Like, you don't want to, if you want to learn all 2000 kanji one a day is going to take you a while. But, you know, the same is true for the newspaper. You don't need to read the whole newspaper every day. Maybe you can read, you know, say, I'm going to read the first two paragraphs of a news article every day or something like that, you know.
That's great. Yeah, no, I think I remember when I studied abroad, the university that I was at, Doshisha, I think a student handed me like a student newspaper, and I took it because I didn't want to be rude. So but like back then, I was like, I'm not going to be able to read this. Like, what am I going to do with this? But for some reason, back then, I was like, you know what? Let me just save it just in case. And I still have it. I still can't read it, but I have it. It's just good to have just in case I want to use it to study. But speaking of
And there's
college days, because that's when I mostly did all my mistakes on Japanese language. I'm sure the other two can agree on this. We've made plenty of language mistakes. Still to this day. Yes.
Yeah.
Plenty of daily.
But you know what? Sometimes mistakes create like really funny moments, and you know, it's really memorable. And then you know that phrase or that word, and you never make that mistake ever again because the consequences were just that bad. Daniel, do you have any like funny like mistake memories that you could share with us that like really just kind of, you know, are super memorable to you?
Yeah, I have one that's so silly, but I guess I'll share it. So when I was teaching on JET, I was really motivated to teach them how to read a little bit, like, and I was trying to do like phonics basically a little bit, and so I was, you know, teaching them some basic phonics and had to introduce the idea of vowels and consonants, right? So the word for vowel in Japanese is boin, and it's an interesting word because it's irregular pronunciation. The characters are mother and sound, which would normally be, you know, haha and oto. And haha, I think, is pronounced usually, bo. Actually, it is a regular pronunciation, but you just don't see it that often. Bo, yeah, sobo is your grandmother, right? So, and then in, that's not too unusual, but the word itself is just not seen that often. And so I wrote it on the board, or I was saying it or something like that, trying to get them to understand it. And they kept laughing at me, these kids. And I guess the Japanese teacher at the time wasn't just saying anything. So I just kind of laughed. And so I wrote it on the board and kind of just shook it off. And I was like, why are these kids laughing at Boeing, you know? And then either like a year later or maybe like with a different level class, I did the same thing. I was doing the same lesson. I was like, okay, I'm learned from my mistake. I'm going to write it on the board right away. So I wrote, you know, haha oto boin on the board. And every time I said it, they were laughing again. I'm like, what is going on?
Yeah, that's, you know, never a good sign. Yeah. Kids laughing at you.
Yeah. And so then this time, I think the assistant principal for that school was like standing in for that class because the homeroom teacher was out that day or something. He was really strict. He was like, shut up. Listen to Daniel Sensei. It's like, but this one kid, like, they were still kind of giggling. And so I was looking around the room, and this one kid like mimed like this with his hands. And it was like, he was kind of like cupping his hands on his chest, making these invisible breasts. And I was like, oh my God, Boeing must be the sound that breasts make when they jiggle.
Oh, so, no.
So I had been saying this word like boing, boing, you know, and these kids are like, oh, like these horny little elementary school kids or something. I don't know. They were like fifth graders. So it's like, I was like, oh my God, I was so embarrassed. And I think I did that lesson, but I was very careful how I referred to vowels and consonants after that. So
yeah,
that's great. I'm crying.
Oh my God. Yeah, as soon as you said boing, I was like, oh my God, I think I know what, like, yeah, because the onomatopoeia sound of those.
Yeah, I had no idea. So that's not really a mistake, but that was a funny thing that, like, you know, where when there are gaps in your cultural awareness, you can kind of run into things like that, but you really need to be able to go with the flow and just kind of like roll with it. Yeah, unfortunately, like, yeah, it didn't, it, I think we got through it, so.
Yeah, that reminded me of, like, I don't know if someone had told the story on the podcast previously, I can't remember, but the Three Little Pigs, is when you're telling the story in English, you say, not by the hair on my chinny chin chin. And I didn't teach this in class, but a friend of mine did. And they said the kids were going nuts, laughing so hard. And she couldn't figure it out. And then her teacher told her, like, it's like, why are they laughing? And then, yeah, hair on your chinny chin chin. And the chin chin means, like, you know, a guy's anatomical part. Remember. So the kids are just laughing their ass off just hearing that, because again, in English, it's chin, 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 you know, like you're talking about your chin. But yeah, it was just one of those things that that person real quick learned what, you know, the phrase not to say in front of your elementary school kids if you want a serious reaction.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I feel like many JET teachers have been, their mistakes in Japanese have been exposed by elementary school kids.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's quite interesting.
But yeah, I mean, it's such a fun experience, all that stuff. So, I mean, I love messing up in Japanese because it makes me remember stuff. But also, it's that good icebreaker. And I've always found that out to be true. But yeah, so, I mean, kind of hit the end of our questions and conversation topics. So I did want to come back and give you a second to kind of like pitch anything you have upcoming, your recent releases. I know you have a bunch of episodes of your podcast series that you may that are coming out weekly. Mm-hmm. You know, your blog, anything else that you want to talk about, go for it. You have the stage. It's all you.
Sure. Yeah, no, thanks. You can find me at How To Japanese on basically every social media platform, Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, TikTok. I have a monthly newsletter on Substack that I'm doing now, and the blog, which I've been running since 2008, which I started on my last year on JET, actually. And yeah, I did a podcast. I've done two seasons of the podcast. 30 episodes are up now that you can listen to. I interview like translators and other people working in Japan with the language to kind of understand how they got to where they are with their language skills, you know, what strategies were effective for them. So definitely give that a listen. And anything else? I think that's it. And my stuff in the Japan Times, which you can, I usually link to out on all my platforms, but you can also, if you Google Daniel Morales Japan Times, or even just search for my name on the Japan Times website, all of those will pop up.
Awesome. Yeah. So go out there if you haven't read Japan Times articles yet. Daniels are a good place to start. Usually great content. Give you, I read them for the language tips because there's a lot of good stuff in there. Just kind of things that you may not have thought of, or kind of tricks to help you learn certain types of phrases or words. So I really, really enjoy and look forward to your articles when they come out, and your blog too. I mean, I've been following your blog since JET. I remember.
Thanks.
You know, I try to really read it as much as possible, but yeah, there were times when I hadn't. Yeah. So I apologize if I missed a few.
no worries. Yeah, no, it started as a for the Fukushima Prefecture newsletter, actually.
Oh, yeah?
When Kai Kadoich was running it, he asked me to write something, and then that was really what sparked the blog and then got me here. So it's been an interesting ride. Yeah, I love helping people with the language. Oh yeah, and then that reminds me, the reading group, US JETA Japanese reading group, you can, if you search for it on Facebook, the group should pop up. All the information will be there. If you search on the US JETA site, it's usually, they include it in their events newsletter and things like that. We are currently doing the second Sunday at noon Central Time. But historically, we've done second Tuesday. I have classes in the evening, so I can't do evening anymore. So we thought, we're doing that, and that's once a month. I usually pick something from Aozora, the public domain literature forum. So this past month, we read a little short piece about mushrooms that somebody had written. And this, I can't remember, I think this next month, we're reading a passage that somebody wrote about rain, what they remember about rain. And just, I kind of look through whatever is being uploaded and try and find something. So yeah, if you're interested in getting a little step up, having a little support as you're getting into more advanced readings, definitely, we would love to have you. Don't have to be a JET. We've been having like about 6 to 10 people every month, which is great. We're getting to critical mass, I think, because they started it through the Chicago chapter, and we were meeting in person for a long time, like back in 2014. and we've been doing it since then, but then we went virtual before the pandemic because people had kind of left and we weren't able to really sustain it. So it dropped off for a little bit, but I was still kind of uploading readings. And then combined with US Jetto, I think we have enough, you know, critical mass and like people on their newsletter list to kind of have at least 5 to 10 people every month, which is great. That's perfect.
That's awesome. Yeah. And just for those listeners out there, it's US JETAA. There's two A's. So US Jetto when you're searching that, just to keep that in mind. But yeah. Well, thank you so much for joining us today. This was a lot of fun. Got a great lot of tips on learning stuff. So I'm looking forward to going and finding those spider monkey short stories wherever I can find them. But yeah. But yeah, thank you again. It's been a pleasure and can't wait to listen to some more of your upcoming episodes on your podcast soon.
Yeah, same.
Yeah, thank you so much. Great to connect with everybody. Hope y'all are all, you know, recovering after Ida. Okay. It's been a rough month or two, but yeah, props for y'all to get this back up so quickly.
We're definitely trying.
We're shaking off the rust.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
For sure.
Yeah. Just like the Saints. Just like the Saints.
Oh, that's a sore subject. Ooh.
We look good in the start. But
yeah. Yeah.
All right. Well, that's going to be it for today. Thanks for joining us, everybody, and listening. And just like that, this week's journey comes to an end. Thank you so much for tuning into our podcast. In this episode, we talked about reading adventures in Japanese. Daniel Morales of Japan Times and How To Japanese Podcast helps shine the light on how to immerse yourself in language through reading and the approaches you can take to get there. Got any Japanese reading material laying around your house? Pick it up and give it a try. If not, what about one of those online resources Daniel dropped during our discussion? There are plenty of other opportunities to pick up language learning lessons through reading various types of media. Why not give one a try? What's your favorite Japanese book? Share with us on Instagram and Twitter at Crew of Japan Podcast, KREWEOFJAPANPODCAST. And check us out on Facebook too. We're trying to grow over there as well. So hit us up, comment on our posts, share your experiences and what you like. While you're there, let your friends know, share one of our posts, retweet, all that kind of stuff. Give us a follow, subscribe. I'm just rambling now. You know what to do. You've heard this 1,000 times by now. Thanks again for listening to our podcast, and that's all for today. Until next time.